Multilingualism and Ethnicity in Baltimore by Daniel Morales and Panthea Parank.
I understand how hard it is. I don't want my children to be like, Mom, you're Chinese. Why don't you teach us Chinese? Why didn't you teach us Chinese when we were kids? They'll say, now I'm in school, I'm learning it, I'm horrible because it's like a second language to me. So I would definitely do the same thing my parents did.
We all have a friend, a colleague, or an acquaintance who can speak another language or their parents still use it. They might have emigrated from their native countries to the US recently or a couple of generations ago. Whether due to religious, political, social, or racial factors, whether they were fleeing persecution, whether they were coming simply for economic advancement, to pursue better educational opportunities, or to join their family in America. All of them brought with them one of the most distinctive human characteristics, language. Welcome to our podcast on multilingualism and multiculturalism in Baltimore. My name is Daniel Morales. I recently received my master's degree in intercultural communication at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC, located in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm a Spanish teacher at UMBC, and previously I taught both Spanish and English in my home country, Chile. I started learning English when I was about 20 years old in 2002, and I came to the US in 2006, where I lived in South Carolina for a year before going back to Chile, and then coming to study in Maryland in 2009. After studying research in the area of bilingualism, the particular issue of heritage language maintenance roused my attention. A commonly accepted definition of a heritage language is the language that is spoken by family members in homes where the dominant language, such as English, is not spoken. Immigrants bring their heritage languages and culture with them to the host countries, but many children of immigrant families can end up losing their heritage language. The issue of language maintenance becomes more and more significant since studies have shown that the heritage language is lost through each passing generation.
I am Panthea Parang, and I'm a PhD student in the Language, Literacy, and Culture program also at UMBC. I spent my childhood up to the age of 11 in Iran, and when I was 14, my family and I moved to Baltimore from New York. Like Daniel, I became aware of bilingualism and multilingualism everywhere around me. Most people in my community had the same Baltimore accent, and in school, because of my accent, I was always asked where I was from. Now, 20 years later, as I have integrated into the Baltimore community and have children of my own, I have become much more aware of my ethnicity and background. I felt it was important for my children to know their ethnic background, even though they were born in the United States and will most likely never return to live in Iran. So I enrolled my son in the weekend Farsi language school, so he could grow up learning about Iran and Farsi language. I have since realized that most ethnic groups have similar weekend language schools and that the issue of multilingualism and ethnicity is important for all immigrants.
In this podcast, we will investigate what people have to say about multilingualism and language contact, how they maintain their home language, how their parents encourage them to learn it, and how they deal or would be willing to deal with their own children. We will be sharing the experiences and insights from 15 people who speak different languages: Spanish, Hindi, Ukrainian, Russian, Vietnamese, and Chinese. In addition, three professors from the Modern Language, Linguistics, and Intercultural Communication Department at UMBC will join us to explain some features of language maintenance and to tell us about their own experiences trying to maintain heritage language in their own families. You will hear all these voices in our podcast as our participants tell you about their experiences.
In this podcast, we are going to cover themes related to language maintenance in three different parts. In the first part, which we call language and ethnic identity, we will see how language plays an important role in the creation of identity. In the second part, which we decided to call one language at home, one language at school, we will discuss how heritage language is spoken at home, with parents and relatives, while English is spoken in most of the other social domains. And finally, in the third part, which we call Why Speak Two Languages, we will see the role of school, family, and society in creating a space where heritage language is valued. Part 1, Language and Ethnic Identity.
it's a part of me, part of my culture, and part of who I am. And a lot of my relatives, they only know Russian. A lot of them live in Israel, and they would know Hebrew. But the only thing that would connect us is being able to speak Russian to each other. And so, you know, versus my relatives living all over the world, speaking Russian is the only way we could communicate.
For our podcast, we interviewed 15 people who speak different languages, Spanish, Hindi, Ukrainian, Russian, Vietnamese, and Chinese, and we asked them questions about the issues of language. The interviews will show us how, although some of the participants are American citizens, many of them still identify themselves as Russian, Chinese, Hispanic, Ukrainian, Vietnamese, or Indian, and view their native and heritage languages as an important identity symbol. When we speak, we're not only communicating, but also negotiating a sense of identity. A heritage language learner's investment into a heritage language is also an investment into their heritage identity, just as language is very much part of an immigrant identity. For immigrants, as well as heritage speakers, therefore, staying connected to and maintaining the language becomes a priority. Let's hear now from two speakers, Mario, who's 30 years old, and who was born in the US to parents from Mexico, and Kaman, a 20-year-old Indian-American man who was born in the US, but who is also a fluent speaker of Hindi.
I want them to speak Spanish. I want them to learn all like the cooking that my mother and her grandmother taught me. I mean, that's kind of like, that's part of a culture that makes you what you are.
I think the values come from like your parents and your grandparents and stuff like that. But I think the reason that we stress on teaching the language is just because it's important to know where you came from. It's important to be able to carry on conversations with the older generation.
As we can see in the case of Mary and Kaman, family values and traditions are part of maintaining heritage language and identity, especially for children, who may need to understand the heritage language in order to participate fully in cultural activities. Luba, a mother of two elementary school children in her mid-40s, discusses how she is finding a balance with her children to teach them Ukrainian, even though they may never return to live in Ukraine.
It's important for us to continue that effort because it's just so enriching, and our children enjoy it. They enjoy having additional friends, knowing people from other towns, having an additional set of, you know, holiday customs or traditions to draw on. So we feel like it's a all-around plus, not an added burden, even though none of us in my family plan to go back to Ukraine other than to visit or to work, but we don't plan to go live there.
What often happens in the US is that despite the reality of our diverse demographics and multiple languages, it is actually typical for the grandchildren of immigrant families to speak English and to have little to no knowledge of their heritage language. And often, those members of the second or third generation who have lost the use of the heritage language may have a great sense of cultural loss or feel that they have lost a marker of identity. For this reason, many immigrant parents work hard to keep the culture and language alive for their children. Here's Marta, a Mexican-born immigrant who moved to Baltimore in 2002. Her son is now 18. Marta and her family frequently travel to Mexico so that her son can have some more exposure to Spanish language.
I don't want him to forget Spanish. And I want him to know more Spanish at the same time because, you know, my family is in Mexico. If he starts forgetting how to speak Spanish, it will be, you know, in a few years impossible to communicate with other relatives over there.
And here is Wanda, a 20-year-old American-born Chinese student who spent part of her childhood with her grandparents in China.
And so when I was in China, they didn't speak English at all, so I had to learn Chinese, and they would make me memorize poems and things, like just what typical Chinese children would learn, the poems about how you shouldn't waste food, about how I guess the communist government was good and stuff.
Wanda's family has tried to preserve her linguistic and cultural heritage by working hard to make sure she maintained her Chinese. Maintaining the heritage language not only provides individual benefits, but also is crucial for intergenerational family cohesion. After all, it is in the family that the peculiar bond with language and language activities is fostered, shared, and fashioned into personal and social identity. Once speakers grow up, however, the challenge can be how to best maintain their heritage language when the dominant community speaks something else. Inés is in her 20s and works as an ESL teacher at UMBC. She was born in the US, but her parents are immigrants from Mexico and Cuba. She wants to maintain Spanish as her heritage language, but she foresees some challenges.
If I marry, you know, if I marry a Latino, and he speaks Spanish, then I think that it'll be easier than if I'm the only one who speaks Spanish.
As Inés notes, it is easier for a person to maintain their heritage language if they are surrounded by it at home. Dr. Ana Maria Schwartz, who's an associate professor and department chair of UMBC's Modern Language and Linguistics Department, echoes the same point.
When students ask me, my advice on how to keep the language, I always tell them to marry somebody who speaks the language.
Adults who are bilingual speakers have the unique opportunity to get to know members of both the minority and majority language communities. By experiencing two or more cultures, bilinguals are able to deeply experience and gain intimate knowledge of different cultures. Such experience can only be gained when one has the ability to communicate in the local language.
In some ways, I think the way I probably grew up, I was more of a chameleon, or I adapted to the environment. So when I was in Mexico, I would act more Mexican. When I was in the United States, we didn't live in a barrio, you know, we lived more in just regular old America, so I would adapt to that.
As Carlos pointed out, being bilingual can help to bridge a gap that is often perceived when two nations or ethnic groups speak different languages. Understanding each other's language is important, but it is also important to be sensitive to different cultural points of view. But although it has many positive aspects to it, bilingualism is not always viewed positively. Many motives encourage or discourage positive attitudes towards heritage languages, ethnic and cultural maintenance, communication with countries of origin, and economic incentives. And although parents generally hold positive views of heritage language maintenance, they often show considerable variation in what aspects of a language they encourage and when they do so.
I guess at the beginning, when we just came here, my parents tried to limit my Russian so that I would be kind of forced to learn more English. But in a couple of years when I was able to learn enough English to, you know, handle myself, my parents figured out that I started forgetting Russian at such an early age. So my dad would try to force me to speak Russian at home, even though I'd respond in English, or I'd just speak to my mom, for example, but my dad would just be like, you know, you need to speak Russian.
You just heard Katerina, a 20-year-old Russian immigrant who came to the US at the age of 9. For people like Katerina, whose parents are minority language monolinguals, or who might have a limited proficiency in English, their bilingual children will be able to communicate with their parents while at the same time being able to succeed in the majority language context. A man who speaks Hindi but was born in the US is 23-year-old. In this next clip, you'll hear a man discuss how he has experienced stereotyping, distrust, and outright hostility from some Americans. Due to political tensions, a man was attacked with political rather than cultural stereotypes.
When it came to school, I used to live in a neighborhood where it was the majority of the people were farmers, and like 95-98% of the school was white, and you got like 5 or 6 Indian kids and 2 or 3 black kids in the school. So yeah, I mean, after 9/11, it was just like I was a terrorist, even though I'm from India. And so, looking Indian and not having an accent, I don't think it like protects you from any bias that people have against you. I mean, just the color of your skin ticks people off sometimes.
Despite the negatives of being from another culture but living in the US, most of the people who we interviewed believe in keeping their status as a hyphenated American. Considering themselves as being from two cultures is a balance for identity that our participants are all living with. Here is Luba explaining.
I guess we would say we are Americans. We are fully Americans, but we have hyphenated Americans. We are Ukrainian Americans.
We also hear the same sentiment from Kim, a hairdresser who was born in Vietnam and came to the US at the age of 9. She has three children ranging from 7 to 15. Her children call themselves Vietnamese, despite being born in the U.S.
Well, they generally just say they are Vietnamese, and they was born here as a... They call they Vietnamese American because they was born here in U.S., but they... Anybody asked them, they said they're Vietnamese.
In the stories we have heard in part one, language is almost always present in identity formation and identity display. Language is an index, symbol, and marker of identity. Ethnic identity for recent immigrants is very strong, and heritage language is used as a tool to foster ethnic pride. At the same time, there are some cases in which the construction of identity for immigrants and heritage language speakers still shifts to being more of an American identity. In part two of our podcast, called One Language at Home, One Language at School, we will continue to explore some of these issues. Part two, One Language at Home, One Language at School.
But I have very few Chinese kids in the school, so under these kind of circumstances, I think they probably identify themselves very, you know, all their friends actually, they're not Chinese friends. You know, sometimes people may say, oh, you have four Chinese people in your school. That necessarily means those four kids will form a group. No, that never happened for my kids' situation. So all their friends, none of them are Chinese, actually.
In part two of our podcast, One Language at Home, One Language at School, we explore the issue of language choice. Places like church or hanging out with friends from a similar background can also help maintain language skills. Here is Raman, a 20-year-old student of Indian heritage who was born in the United States. Listen to him talk about how the importance of family connections in helping him maintain his fluency in Hindi.
I speak it at home. At home, that's the only language we speak. We tend not to speak English because my grandparents don't understand it, and they live with us. And then, like you said, whenever we hang out with a lot of other Indian people, and so we tend to talk amongst friends. You know, like when we want to say something that we want other people to know.
And sometimes when the home language isn't maintained in the home, it becomes very difficult for the child to be fluent. Halina, a 20-year-old student who was born in the U.S., tells us about her father, whose family was from the Ukraine but did not speak much Ukrainian at home.
My dad, he grew up in a very Ukrainian neighborhood, and he went to Ukrainian school. But I really don't think he learned much himself. Like, I know he spoke it when he was a child, but, like, I don't think they actually spoke it in his house very often. So it's not something he really held on to. And so it just never got passed on.
Raman's grandparents made an effort for him to learn to speak Hindi, but he has lost the ability to read and write in the language.
When I was younger, my grandparents taught me how to read and write in my language. But since I didn't practice it, I don't remember how to do it now.
The influence of his grandmother was also important for Aman.
My grandmother taught us when we were young. Like, it was like we had her influence. I mean, my parents never really tried to teach us, but my grandmother kind of forced it. So I know how to read and write a little bit, but it's like, you know, 50-50.
Let's hear more on this point of the difficulty of becoming literate in two languages from Dr. Thomas Field, who is a professor of modern languages, linguistics, and intercultural communication at UMBC.
Mastering two languages is a task, even for a child. We don't think about it, but it is. They do it quickly, but still, to maintain those two languages, it's a real task. Getting to the stage of literacy is an additional task. Many of them never get there. But even just fluent speaking ability in two languages is a burden to them at a certain level. And there have to be really serious reasons for them to maintain two languages.
We also heard from one of our experts, Dr. Schwartz, on this topic. Her own daughter, she says, was always fluent in English, but never truly became bilingual in Spanish. However, she did benefit from learning about Cuban culture when she visited her grandparents in Miami during summers.
And she actually does speak Spanish. Her Spanish is functional but fractured. But she learned it because I would send her to my parents in Miami every summer. So she attained a degree of biculturalism that is actually probably more developed than her bilingualism.
These stories from our speakers make clear the importance of the home and the family in maintaining heritage language fluency. The famous linguist Joshua Fishman has suggested that the best way to approach the issue of language choice, especially in multilingual communities, is by understanding who speaks what language to whom and in which setting. In fact, Fishman states that whether or not a language is practiced in the home is the most critical factor in predicting whether that language would be maintained across generations. Let's hear more on this point from Dr. Field.
What typically happens is that the family has friends who speak the immigrant language, but the children are in neighborhoods where they're also dealing with monolingual English speakers. So very early on, they're using English with children, and English becomes the language of children for them in many, many cases, most cases, unless they've got closed networks. They're in a Chinese neighborhood and they only interact with Chinese children. That's unusual. Other than that, children have a sense that the diglossia, the functional distribution of the languages, is such that one language is children's language, one language is home language. Adults, you can't tell. It could be one or the other. And I saw with my own children, for example, that's what they did. They, for them, children spoke English. Their family spoke French. And adults, they sort of looked at them and tried to figure out which is it going to be, English or French, and they made a choice based on a number of different things.
Dr. Field refers in his quote to the concept of diglossia, which emerges when two coexisting languages of a community have different functions and are used in different situations and contexts. In bilingualism and diglossia, the terms high language and low language are often used to refer to the different social positions that two coexisting languages often hold within one community. The term low language is used to refer to the language that is acquired informally at home and that is used in similar interactions, while the term high language refers to the language of higher social position. This is a language that is learned at school and it is used in educational and government arenas. Because students in the school generally speak the dominant language most of the day, there is often a great deal of switching that goes on between the so-called high and low languages, depending on who's speaking to whom and when. Let's listen to Marta tell us about how and when her son and his friend use Spanish at school and why they don't.
He is from Mexico too, but they only see each other during lunch or after the school. But I think I realize that they don't speak Spanish. They meet when they don't want somebody else to know what they are talking about, they switch to Spanish, but it's mostly in English because they are around, you know, Americans. So the other friends are American.
Sometimes, however, the early years of schooling can be a time when students can lose their fluency in their native or heritage language because their home languages are not reinforced within the school context. Here is Leanne, who tells us about her daughter's early Chinese language learning. But then after attending English-speaking daycare in Baltimore, her Chinese began to fade.
One of my kids was in Chinese school. When she turned to 3, she was fluent in Chinese at that time. So, but then after we came to Baltimore, I have to send her to you know, a regular daycare here. So she pretty much lost almost everything. And then later, both of them have 1 or 2 years Chinese learning experience in a local Chinese school, but I don't think they return that much.
A similar experience has happened to Kim, who is a Vietnamese hairdresser in her 40s. Kim tells us about how her son Darcy had a difficult time adjusting to two languages.
When he was in first grade, he had what's called language confusing. We speak a lot of Vietnamese at home when they was a little. When he was in school, he have a difficulty of understanding because he tries to separate Vietnamese and English because we don't use any English at home. So he very confused.
And here's Carlos, who describes what happened to his language skills when he came back to the U.S. after having spent time in Mexico.
It took me a few months to learn English. It did. When I first, my mom took me to the school, they tested me in English. I couldn't answer the question, so, you know, they said, oh, mentally retarded or whatever, you know, learning disability. They weren't as politically correct back then. So this is just interesting, right? With a Mexican, so my mom spoke English, but she had an accent. She was obviously Mexican. when my dad went back with me, or just when they spoke to my dad, and my dad said, no, there's nothing wrong with him, that, you know, it'll just take him a few months to get back into learning English, so.
As we've heard, sometimes schools can hinder a student's bilingual development. But sometimes, too, there can be resistance to maintaining those home languages on the parts of the students themselves. Dr. Field discusses this point.
There's resistance, starting at around age 5. And that's difficult. Sometimes the parents just give up. They start mixing languages, code switching. Sometimes the kids ultimately lose the home language between 5 and 10. From my experience, when I've watched these things happen, up to age 5, it's very easy to maintain two languages in a child. Very easy. You make sure that you speak one language at home, the child sees other people, they travel, those kinds of things, and they juggle the two. And there are cases of children sort of losing some of the language and then realizing how important it was and gaining it back, because you don't lose everything. You have that strong passive competence even if you stop speaking it for a few years. And so, yeah, if there is a good reason, you can get it back. Now, my kids were a little like that. Between 5 and 10, they weren't interested in speaking French anymore. And so we could have said when they come home, okay, you have to speak French. We won't talk to you unless you speak it. But then they would just go upstairs to their room and they wouldn't even talk to us because they were just too tired. Then when they got to be a little older, around 10, their cousins, they discovered their cousins in France knew all kinds of swear words that they really enjoyed, and they wanted to go back and learn the language.
This is exactly how Wanda felt when she was younger. But by the time she was an adult, she recognized the cultural and social benefits of being bilingual and bicultural.
When I was a kid, of course, I really didn't want to. I hated it, and I thought it was weird. But now that I know that it's great to have another language because it sounds cool. You can say, I know another language. But also, the fact that you're in America and you have to have, I am Chinese. Like, when people look at me, they know I'm Chinese. And if I don't know how to speak my language, I feel kind of ashamed that I don't. So as I got older, I felt so much better about knowing it. And now that I know that when I have kids, I really want them to learn, because China's like growing in the world economy, and it'd be good for them to know it from childhood and not have to learn it in the future.
And the same thing happened to Katerina, a 20-year-old who came to the U.S. from Russia at the age of 9. You'll hear her talk about how her resistance to speaking Russian and the cultural and familial challenges that it posed when she began to lose her fluency in that language.
Well, at that age, I was, you know, it was like I was 10 or 11, so of course I didn't want to do what my parents told me. You know, I'd retaliate by speaking English anyway. But, you know, as time went by, I understood that, you know, if I don't practice it, I just forget it. And at one point, my grandmother came back into America, and I couldn't talk to her in Russian. Like, you know, I'd be able to talk to her, but I wouldn't be able to say like a fluid sentence.
In my own household, I've decided to enroll my children in Farsi classes to help them maintain their Farsi and give them a community where other children like themselves are speaking Farsi together. I've often heard from other parents, especially women, that they have enrolled their children in similar classes. Let's hear more on that point from our third expert, Dr. Omar Ka, who is an associate professor of modern languages and linguistics at UMBC. In this next clip, you'll hear Dr. Ka explain the role of family members, especially women in the family, in encouraging children to maintain their native or heritage language.
Women have that role of preserving the language. Therefore, they are seen as really, you know, literally the guardians of the language, right? And that is transposed here, you know, when they immigrate, because, you know, at home, they are seen as the ones who should teach the children the native language, who should maintain the native language in the children, more than men.
But not all parents have the intention or desire for their children to maintain their mother tongue. Parents often experience tremendous pressure to assimilate, especially when dominant situations do not do much to support the maintenance of home languages. Dr. Ka talks about some of the pressures that some parents face and why they might prefer that their children just focus on being fluent in English.
For different reasons. It might be because, okay, they feel that the children need to learn English because English is a language of advancement, language of power, etc. So they might feel, in order for us to really, you know, assimilate into this new culture, our children need to learn English. Therefore, we are not going to make any particular effort.
Some parents who we interviewed talked about their children's identity as Americans and how they have mastered English, sometimes at the expense of their home language. Let's hear from Na, a Chinese immigrant who came to the United States 11 years ago. Her daughter has mastered English like a native speaker, and as Na says, she is becoming more American than Chinese.
Well, I think when they grow up, I think Pearl probably will be more American. I mm-hmm. see a lot of like kids grow up here, they're more American. Mm-hmm. They speak totally native English, and the way they're living and the thinking, you know, because of the school and their friends, they are more like American.
Linguists have found that the younger generation's proficiency in the heritage language depends quite a bit on whether the parents encourage or discourage its use in the home. It can also depend on the attitude that other Americans have toward the heritage language and whether or not they see it as having value or contributing toward success. Language maintenance can also depend on geography and economics, how far and how expensive it is to travel back and forth to heritage country. Here is Dr. Ka's take on the difficulties that his children face in maintaining their fluency in Wolof, which is spoken in Dr. Ka's native country of Senegal.
They are more likely to maybe lose Wolof over time. That's what I'm suspecting, even though that's not what I want, but that's reality of immigration in this country. So that's the situation. I think that factor, that proximity to the home country, it becomes really important in that case, right? People have argued in the case of Spanish that the maintenance of Spanish is due, among other things, to the proximity of the Spanish-speaking country, like Mexico or Latin American countries, where children can travel easily, you know, and keep those relations going all the time, you see?
As we have learned in this section of our podcast, immigrant parents and grandparents might consider it imperative that their children and grandchildren learn and use the language of their heritage culture. But outside pressures ranging from practicality to politics and economics can hinder language maintenance. There are also personal and family-based factors such as attitudes toward the heritage culture and desire to assimilate into dominant cultures, which can affect language choice and language maintenance. Without intergenerational mother tongue transmission, language maintenance is not possible because what is not transmitted cannot be maintained. Next, in part 3 of our podcast, Why Speak Two Languages, we will look at why speaking two languages is important for immigrants. Part 3, Why Speak Two Languages?
They wanted me not to forget my roots, just in case. They said it wasn't really for a cultural purpose as much as because China is getting, you know, more and more stronger in the global economy, and they said it's a good idea. It's more useful for your future if you can speak both languages.
What benefits will be there in the future for our speakers to maintain their heritage languages? For many of them, there are connections between language, culture, and identity. Many business, cultural, political, and social activities around the world call for people with different linguistic and cultural skills. Heritage language and heritage culture skills are important resources that can contribute to the nation's future success and are demanded in the global marketplace. Let's hear from two of our speakers, Ines and then Kim, on this topic.
Not only, you know, they weren't only thinking, oh, when, you know, it'll make you more marketable or, you know, more competitive. It was for our family, you know, like, they spoke Spanish and it was like disrespectful, I think, to not speak Spanish or to not learn Spanish.
Since I was born in Vietnam, and I'm my first citizen of Vietnam, citizen, so it's very important for my kids to know my language, and also their father also Vietnamese, so it's very important. And it's good for the future if they know more than one language for work and communicate with other people outside.
As Ines and Kim mentioned, bilinguals can have more potential job opportunities than monolinguals. As the world market becomes increasingly transnational, bilingualism will undoubtedly continue to be a highly valued and sought-after skill. As Elina, a retired Foreign Service officer originally from Ukraine, states.
So I am convinced that if a child is the more languages a child is exposed to, the more open the mind is to accept different intonations or languages. So that's one thing. So that's to convince people, because somebody says, well, I can't learn. That's not true, especially if you look at immigrants. I'm an immigrant. I came in here when I was 8 years old. So that's one thing. The other thing is to maintain the level of education. That has to be personal. I think the idea of having public schools acknowledge foreign languages and giving and providing them, that's very useful.
Elena raises a point that mainstream educational settings, not just the effort by immigrant families and local ethnic communities, have an important role to play in preserving multilingualism. Because they are formal institutions with power in society, schools and daycares are crucial places where children can form positive attitudes toward their heritage, language, and culture. But sometimes, not all languages are valued equally in American society. As the linguist Joseph Eastman has argued, languages that are perceived as more valuable in society tend to attract higher levels of language loyalty. The prestige of a language is therefore considered one of the biggest motivating factors for maintaining heritage language. We asked Dr. Schwartz about some of the common beliefs about language programs that have circulated in the US throughout recent years. There have often been questions in schools over how best to educate English language learners, and too often these students have been underserved. Here's Dr. Schwartz on what can go wrong when school systems do not support the maintenance of languages other than English and how it can affect students.
The educational system does believe that there is an inherent value in learning another language. It just doesn't believe in maintaining the one you brought. Okay? So basically the kid goes into school, he gets absolutely no support in that language. They're brought up, they're at home functioning in this native language, being taken care of by grandmothers, and, you know, caretakers are always in that native language. And then they start going to school and they start losing it, and they start acquire English very, very fast. And they are not encouraged in any way by the educational institution at that level to continue developing their native language. They lose it. They get to middle school, and they get to high school, and then they get to college, and we all say, well, you have to have another language. You have to have another language. They've been developing more and more what they call dual language programs, which take heritage speakers of the language of the dual program and put them together with non-heritage speakers, and they both progress through these. Yeah. And those are becoming more popular, and they have been a way of addressing this loss of bilingual opportunities for students, but they're very few.
Because they cannot depend on schools to help their children maintain their heritage language, parents often have to take concrete steps to create a rich linguistic and cultural environment for their children, like Carlos does for his children, for example.
I try to do things. I take them to school and pick them up. I speak to her in Spanish then. The school that she's... We put her in a Montessori school, and they teach... They talk to them in Spanish half an hour a day, 4 days a week, so she gets those Spanish classes. Then this summer, she's not taking Spanish immersion, maybe next year, but she is going to these camps in the morning.
Although the scope of this podcast has been small in comparison to the vast and broad topic of multilingualism, we have heard from our speakers many interesting linguistic, social, cultural, and educational experiences relating to language maintenance. We hope that our podcast will help foster positive attitudes toward native and heritage language preservation in the public, especially among students and parents, but also among school administrators and teachers. Teachers are essential figures in language education because their attitudes, beliefs, and actions greatly influence those of the students and affect the larger school environment. We believe in the importance of valuing students' cultural experiences in language learning, the linguistic and cultural backgrounds of immigrants and their children and grandchildren are valuable resources that facilitate their own learning and can contribute to a richer and more interesting curriculum for all students. The voices of the speakers we have heard on our podcast challenge us to examine our views and ideologies about language, and they help us build a vision for the future in which there are optimal learning opportunities for the increasing number of linguistically diverse people in American society.
Thanks for listening to our podcast on multilingualism and ethnicity in Baltimore. We would like to thank the people who agreed to share their voices for this podcast: Wanda, Helena, Katerina, Ines, Mario, Kaman, Luba, Marta, Carlos, Aman, Na, Kim, Leanne, Roman, and Elohina. And also Dr. Field, Dr. Ka, and Dr. Schwartz, who kindly agreed to be part of this podcast. Without their help, this project could have not been possible. We would especially like to thank Dr. Christine Mallinson, who encouraged us to work on this podcast and supported us along the way. And finally, to our classmates, Heidi Faust, Holly Catherine Britton, Inte De Shields, and Laura Strickling, for their ideas and assistance.
谢谢收听我们的节目，下次再见。
मुझे सुनने के लिए धन्यवाद। जल्द ही मिलते हैं।
Gracias por escuchar nuestro podcast. Hasta pronto.